Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to MitoAction's monthly expert series. Today, Dr. Oscar Henry Meyer, Professor of Clinical Pediatrics at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania and attending pulmonologist at CHOP, is with us to share managing challenges and maximizing success in chronic mechanical ventilation. My name is Stephanie Harry. I'm the Patient Support Coordinator at MitoAction and will be your host for today. Today's presentation will be recorded and available on MitoAction's website in the coming days, as well as on our podcast, Apple Podcast, and Spotify. We encourage you to ask questions throughout the presentation using the Q&A feature in the bottom menu bar of your screen. The chat section is for you to talk with other families and clinicians who are in the space, but it is really helpful if you put all of your questions for the presenter in the Q&A section, and not in the chat. This helps me to stay a little bit more organized at the end of today's presentation. We will try to get to as many questions as possible. Mechanical ventilation can be a critical component of a comprehensive and successful plan to support a patient's respiratory needs and helping them maximize their quality of life and reach their full potential. Doing so successfully starts with and continues to center around a discussion with a patient and his or her family about what their wishes are for the type of respiratory support and then customizing that approach accordingly. This discussion will review different approaches towards successful respiratory support for patients with mitochondrial disease. Without further ado, I would like to introduce Dr. Oscar Henry Meyer. Dr. Meyer is a professor of clinical pediatrics at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania and an attending pulmonologist with the Division of Pulmonology at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, also known as CHOP. He is the medical director of CHOP Pulmonary Function Testing and is actively involved in specialized care of patients with neuromuscular disease and complex chest wall and spinal deformity. He's been the pulmonologist in the Neuromuscular Center for the last 23 years and in the Center for Thoracic Insufficiency Syndrome since its inception 20 years ago. He is on a number of national committees and study groups involved in pediatric pulmonary function testing and the assessment and management of children with complex thoracospinal disorders and neuromuscular disorders. He's lectured nationally and internationally and published over 90 journal articles and book chapters in his research and clinical interests. Dr. Meyer, we are so excited to have you back here today and to dive into this topic. We really appreciate your continued wisdom in this space. This topic of home ventilation and trachs is something that comes up a lot on our support calls and also with patients who call in. And I think it's a really hard and sensitive topic to discuss. So we really, really appreciate you taking the time to educate us and help walk us through mechanical ventilation.
Great. Thank you for the opportunity to speak again to you. And let me see if I can share my screen. And you should see my first slide. All right. Good. All right. So let's get going. So thank you for the very nice introduction, Stephanie. And so I've had the privilege of taking care of a number of patients with different neuromuscular conditions, including mitochondrial disorders. And we'll go through this, and it should take a little over 40 minutes or so. So there should be plenty of time for questions and hopefully answers that satisfy you afterwards. So I have these disclosures. I'm a consultant or on scientific advisory board and have given lectures for a number of these organizations, none of which influence the content today or have any part of mitochondrial treatment. So this is the outline. I'd like to talk about six different things. First, just talk about what is hypoventilation, what does it mean, and then its impact, how to evaluate for it, some of the treatment options, and then the challenges, how to manage them, and then maximizing success. So let's start with the first question of what is hypoventilation? And hypoventilation, as the name would imply, is underventilation due to one of two things, either an inability to breathe in enough during a minute, what we call minute ventilation, and that's the product of the size of your breath, tidal volume, or respiratory rate. And in patients that have muscle weakness, the tidal volume can gradually become low, meaning that it can be harder to breathe, maintain ventilation unless you increase the respiratory rate. And sometimes patients who have abnormal brain activity are not able to recognize the need to increase respiratory rate to compensate for low minute ventil I'm sorry, low tidal volume. And in addition, sometimes this can be secondary to pharmacotherapies. When I have patients who have seizure disorder and are on anti-seizure medicine, sometimes those medicines can suppress the drive to breathe. That can also happen after procedural sedation or after intubation for acute respiratory illness. Ultimately, the outcome of it is a combination of high carbon dioxide, which we call hypercarbia, and eventually hypoxemia or low oxygen. So let's talk about the impact of hypoventilation. If you were to acutely have an increase in your carbon dioxide level, as I mentioned a couple slides ago, the response would be to increase either your respiratory rate or the size of breath as part of increased work of breathing. The problem from that is that even if you're able to normalize things, you're working harder to breathe than you should. And so typically, breathing is a fairly, a process that requires not a whole lot of energy. And the body then recognizes that and can shunt calories to other organ system functions. And if that is not the case, then you take calories from other parts of the body, and you can end up, if you're in untreated respiratory failure or untreated hypoventilation, patients can actually lose weight and can become malnourished. In terms of the pure gas exchange component, if you have high carbon dioxide, the kidney can compensate for that to maintain a normal acid-base balance. For hypoxemia, what happens with that when you have low oxygen is that if it's throughout the entire body, I'm sorry, throughout the entire lung and not just a small part of the lung, what happens is that the vessels in the lungs will constrict to try and shunt blood from one part of the lung that's not getting a lot of oxygen to another part. The problem is that if the whole lung is exposed to low oxygen and the vessels constrict, it puts extra strain on the right side of the heart to pump blood through the lungs, and that can cause increased pulmonary blood pressure. And that added strain is additional calories, require additional calories, and that leads to decreased energy. And then, as is the case with hypercarbia and breathing fast, weight loss and failure to thrive. So, not a good situation. So, this is a slide that came out from a paper over 20 years ago looking at patients with muscular dystrophy in Newcastle in the UK. And what they did is they looked at different clinical interventions over different decades, going from patients who passed away in the 1960s in the left graph to patients who passed away in the 1990s, which was the most recent epoch of time. And so you can see that as time went on, their ability to take care of patients improved and the survival rate improved commensurate with that. Now, what they did is they took the patients who passed away in the 90s when we were beginning to be able to do reliable home mechanical ventilation and looked at the portion of extracted the patients who actually were given mechanical ventilation as an option for care. And their survival actually increased substantially beyond that of the cohort of patients who did not use mechanical ventilation. So, to state the obvious, clearly mechanical ventilation has a huge impact on survival. And now is widely offered to all patients without bias. It certainly should not be restricted in any way. So, how do we evaluate for hypoventilation? While there are clinical findings that might suggest it, they can't be diagnostic. And so what we do is do a sleep study. And this is data from a sleep study. And at the top, That's the sleep stage. You have when you do a sleep study, you have EEG leads over the head, and that allows the person interpreting the study to assess what stage of sleep a patient's in. And the sleep stage that we want to look at is something called REM, or rapid eye movement sleep, and that's where we rest and recover, in part because our muscles relax and are virtually paralyzed, and that there's no movement at all. And if you have weak muscles on top of that during that REM sleep, you can have problems with breathing in deeply enough to bring in the oxygen you need or remove the carbon dioxide. And so when we do a sleep study, we get this type of a picture, and we can sort of, go down from those thick bars at the top that indicate REM sleep and see, right around in here, that there are a number of respiratory events that are associated with REM sleep. And then as we go down here to carbon dioxide, there are a number of periods where the carbon dioxide is peaking above 50 millimeters of mercury, which is the upper edge of normal. Thankfully, our sleep colleagues will produce data, and this is an example of what data would be extracted. And the normal carbon dioxide for a healthy person is between 35 and 45. And so this particular patient had 80% of their sleep where their carbon dioxide level was slightly elevated, and 17% of the night where their carbon dioxide was above 50, which is typically the threshold that gets people concerned. The one thing that I do want to point out is some people will say, well, instead of dealing with doing a sleep study, can we just monitor the oxygen? And here, and in this particular situation, in spite of having elevated carbon dioxide, the oxygen level was actually normal for 99.9% of the sleep time. So if we had looked at oxygen, we would have had what I would consider an inappropriate conclusion that this patient is doing perfectly fine. So then one of the questions that we're currently asking is, are the criteria that we typically use to determine if somebody is hypercarbic, has high carbon dioxide, appropriate? And the standard American Society for Sleep Medicine criteria is a carbon dioxide above 50 for greater than 20% of sleep. And so the question we're asking is, having a carbon dioxide above 50 for less than 20% of sleep, is that normal? And that's the example we had here. This patient was not classified as having hypoventilation, in spite of the fact that close to 98% of their sleep time was with an elevated carbon dioxide. And this is something that we're addressing so that we can more aggressively and proactively identify hypoventilation in patients with all types of neuromuscular disease. And so we're asking some questions about what the appropriate threshold is for high carbon dioxide. Whoops, I'm sorry. And then one of the other things is that we study patients when they're well, for a good reason. We want to know what their day-to-day breathing is at night. But the problem is that that does not correspond with how a patient is doing when they're sick. And so one of the things we try very hard to do is identify patients who are doing okay, but may be at risk of having hypoventilation or breathing difficulty when they fall ill. One of the other challenges that we have is that if we say everybody needs to get a sleep study twice a year, which we're not recommending, but if we were to say everybody needs frequent regular sleep studies, we don't have the capacity in the sleep medicine lab system to be able to do that. And so one of the things that we're looking to do is to try and come up with alternate approaches and try and reserve sleep studies for patients that are at highest risk of having hypoventilation. So one of the challenges that we have is that most of the patients that go to a sleep lab for a sleep study are going because of questions of obstructive sleep apnea, people that have snoring and breathing difficulty because of upper airway obstruction. And granted, that can certainly happen in patients with neuromuscular disease, But the bigger concern, of course, is whether you have hypoventilation. So one of the things that can cause some confusion is one of the criteria for determining obstructive sleep apnea is certainly apnea, which is where you have a pause in breathing where no air goes in because of upper airway obstruction. There's also something called hypopnea, which is where there's a 50% decrease in flow, and then asynchronous breathing, and then a mild oxygen desaturation. The problem with that is that the same three things can occur if you have weak breathing muscles because of neuromuscular disease, and you go into deep sleep and you underbreathe a little bit. And the concern is that sometimes that can be misinterpreted as an obstructive hypopnea due to upper airway obstruction and not considered as a possible indication of underbreathing because of neuromuscular disease. And we're working on refining sleep medicine guidelines to reflect that. And if a sleep medicine doctor is interpreting from the paradigm of neuromuscular disease and hypoventilation, they should be able to reconcile this when they do their interpretation. There are a number of other things that we can do. Now, I mentioned that sleep studies are limited to major medical centers. And the other issue is that a sleep study to evaluate for hypoventilation needs to have carbon dioxide. And so, one of the challenges in doing, once you finally get access to a sleep lab, is making sure that it is a sleep lab that monitors carbon dioxide. And one of the big challenges in sending a child or an adult to a sleep lab is that they're not sleeping in their own bed. They're sleeping in a bed that has a plastic mattress and an uncomfortable sheet on top of it, in addition to a bunch of wires attached to your head and other wires connected to other monitoring equipment. So it's inherently uncomfortable. And so one of the other things that we've started to look at is doing home capnography, not a home sleep study, but just doing a home measurement of carbon dioxide. And that can be done with a monitor called a transcutaneous carbon dioxide monitor. And we're working on a model that we're replicating from our adult colleagues at Penn to do home capnography. And that provides a number of advantages. One, you can sleep in your own bed. You don't have a bunch of monitors on the head, so that gives you a more real-life assessment and can be relatively easily done. It just requires asking a medical equipment company or another entity that has capnographs to go and deliver one unit to home to record overnight. So this is what we get from a transcutaneous CO2 monitor. The graph at the top is a representation of the carbon dioxide value down below. And again, 45 is normal. 45 or below is normal. And above 45 is abnormal. And obviously, as you go up, that's increasing gradients of or levels of abnormality. And then what it does over on the left in the red boxes that I've encircled, it gives you a mean value for carbon dioxide, including a maximum and a minimum. And then it gives you a portion of time above 50, because that is the threshold that at least classically has been a concern. And then it looks also on the red box on the bottom left, the portion of time that, I'm sorry, how many periods of prolonged hypoventilation defined as over 5 minutes does the patient have? Then over to the right, and the red box that gives you an indication of the percent of sleep time that a patient's carbon dioxide was above 45, above 50, and then above 55. And you can see, at least in this example, that portion was quite was the majority of the sleep time. So this would certainly, just from these data, indicate that this patient has hypoventilation, and this did not require coming to the sleep lab. What we can't do is talk about REM sleep and whether these periods of high carbon dioxide correlate with REM sleep. But frankly, from a pure hypoventilation diagnosis standpoint, that question really isn't all that important. So, one of the other things that we did, I am hinted along the way that the general feeling above among those of us that take care of patients with neuromuscular disease is that the criteria for diagnosing hypoventilation is inadequate. We assembled a group about 5 years ago to try and dig into this, and I identified a group of 15 pediatric pulmonologists, who all of whom had expertise in neuromuscular disease, and then two-thirds had additional expertise in sleep medicine. And so what we did is we reviewed what information is out there from recommendations and guidelines. In other words, we reviewed the literature and then applied that to our own experience, and then had a series of surveys that we did on three separate rounds, and then we came up with some criteria. And so what we decided to do is define what is abnormal, or what threshold we should use to say that this patient with neuromuscular disease is having hypoventilation and needs breathing support. And so we classified that under high carbon dioxide and low oxygen. And what we chose to do is to lower the threshold that's recommended in sleep medicine to the upper edge of normal, which is 45 millimeters of mercury. And if we have a patient that has a quarter of sleep above that threshold, we felt that that is enough to be able to say this patient needs support. If we had shorter periods of higher carbon dioxide of above 50, that would be enough to also diagnose hypoventilation. And then if the patient went to sleep and their carbon dioxide when they were asleep was 10 millimeters of mercury above what they are when they're awake, we felt that also was an indication of hypoventilation. Then we had similar thresholds for the mean oxygen level at night, and then periods of low oxygen defined as below 90%. And so we felt that these lower thresholds were important, especially in somebody that has progressive muscle weakness, because if we are able to identify that early and we accept the reality that things are likely to get worse, then we can treat somebody before they have more significant symptoms. And ultimately, that can improve quality of life and improve functioning during the day. The other thing that we did is I mentioned that we also want to know, who do I have to worry about? Who, if they get sick, is likely to have breathing difficulty and require ventilation? So we defined a transitional zone where we had patients that still were able to keep a normal carbon dioxide, but they did that at the cost of breathing faster, as we talked about before, and then breathing with more effort. And so we had a way of defining that so that if that was present, in spite of the fact that the carbon dioxide and oxygen was normal, that this is at least a patient who doesn't necessarily need ventilation support now, but may if they have additional stress, such as having an acute illness. The other approach that we, the other reason we wanted to do this was we wanted to be able to have a clearer, more objective way of defining hypoventilation, which traditionally has been, well, when was this patient started on BiPAP or started on ventilation? And that's an intervention. That's not a physical threshold. And so I wanted to get a better idea of that. And that also provides potential for saying, well, I have been on BiPAP. I feel like the medicine that I'm on and my general status has improved. I want to see if I'm actually okay off of ventilation. And we don't really have a great approach for that. And using these criteria, you can say, well, I'd like to try sleeping off of my ventilation, and I'm going to track my carbon dioxide and see if it stays in the normal range. And so this gives us the ability to do that. With that, let's move into once we've identified hypoventilation, how do we treat it? And there are really two parts. The most important part by far is over on the left. It's how do we get the air in? What is the interface? The traditional interface for nighttime ventilation is a nasal interface. When we have patients who have breathing difficulty during the day, there are mouthpiece interfaces that can be used. If a patient's struggling with the mouth being open, or we can't get an adequate response, ventilatory response, using a nasal interface, then we can use an interface over the mouth and nose. And then, as Stephanie implied earlier, there's always the question of using a tracheostomy tube. And I'm going to go into some of the considerations a little bit later. And there also is another mode of ventilation, which is actually using a cuirass or something on the body itself that's not used widely because it has some challenges and it's not quite as refined as the typical approach for nasal ventilation. And then the next part is the ventilator. There are ventilators that are made to be used intermittently at night, called respiratory support devices or BiPAP units, and ventilators that are made to be used continuously at nighttime and during the day. And they are obviously have different mechanics and, of course, a different price point. And so, if you need to be on some type of ventilatory support, your pulmonologist will determine which of those you would need. There are two general ways of delivering air. One is by delivering air up to a set pressure, or delivering a certain volume, sort of like pushing a volume out through a syringe. And for pressure, there's negative pressure ventilation also, which is like the old iron lungs, or using a shell on the chest that applies negative pressure to pull the chest open. Both of those approaches are completely valid, but require quite a bit of training and practice. So this is a somewhat dated set of pictures of different types of masks. And so the masks up at the top have a silicone-based interface that typically will balloon up once air is going through it to provide an air cushion. And then many of them will have a way of balancing pressure on the nasal bridge and then on the forehead, as those three devices at the top do. The bottom device is a gel-filled interface, which, just like an athletic mouth guard, can be heated up and can be applied to the nose to be able to get a reasonable seal and to sort of customize to the patient's facial structure. These three at the bottom were designed for adults, and before we had device, say, interfaces that were appropriate for children, we used these smaller interfaces, which were made to go over the tip of an adult nose, to go over the full nose of a smaller child. But thankfully, now we have devices that are now custom made or made specifically for children. Now that we have FDA approval to use non-invasive ventilation in children. Here are some other strategies. We can use a cannula interface, which goes right into the nose. And then there's a fairly substantial tube that either will go around the ears and down to the front, or up and over the head, or can be swiveled around. And there are always, every year at our meetings, there's some new device that has some additional advantage in terms of being fairly small and less distracting, or less less in blocking vision, because nobody likes to have something on their nose. Here's a device that can that's more of an oral device. The device over on the left has a nasal interface and then a strap to help keep the mouth closed. And then the device over to the right actually goes over the nose and part of the mouth. And then this is actually a full face mask that goes over the mouth and nose. And this is something that has some advantages in that it gets away from having patients having us have to worry about the mouth opening up. The problem is that it's a potential problem that if you happen to vomit or have because of having air swallowing into the lungs, I'm sorry, into the stomach, you vomit into the mask and there's a risk of aspiration. It's a risk that thankfully I've never seen in the small number of patients that I've had on oral nasal or full face masks in the hospital. The mask over to the right is a mask that came out around the time that Avatar was there. And so a lot of kids thought it was kind of cool and looked like an Avatar mask. I was dubious about whether patients would actually like it. And actually, there's a good portion of our younger patients that use this mask and seem to do well with it. So if you have the problem of the mouth opening up at night, which is not uncommon in patients with neuromuscular disease, you can use the interface over to the left that has a built-in chin strap, or just use a chin strap, which is essentially a belt that goes around with a little hole to support the chin, and then an elastic, I'm sorry, a Velcro band that attaches around the back of the head. There also is mouthpiece ventilation, which can be used while the patient's up and about during the day. And this is an example of that type of device mounted to a ventilator on the back of a wheelchair. And at least in that situation, the circuit for the ventilator goes through an articulating arm that functions very much like a microphone stand on a podium. And this mouthpiece can be bent. I'm sorry, the circuit can be bent so that the mouthpiece is literally right by the patient's mouth. So all they need to do is turn their head a bit to the side, put their lips around the mouthpiece, and start breathing, and they're fully supported. Here's another example of that type of circuitry. And with this particular device, it has a clamp that can be mounted to any solid structure. It could be mounted to a wheelchair, as in the previous image. Here it can be mounted to a table, a desk, a chair. And you can also actually use mouthpiece ventilation without the actual circuit, but that would require having a patient that has upper extremity arm and hand function to be able to lift the circuit up to their mouth and then remove it and put it back on their lap. Of note, in between breaths, the ventilator is on standby and it does not have air blowing through it. And that's been an advance that has been present for about 10 years. So, tracheostomy tube is a completely valid way of providing support. We'll talk about advantages and disadvantages. There are two different types of tracheostomy tubes. There are ones that have a cuff, and you can see the little balloon thing over in the right image. And that cuff is inflated to keep the tracheostomy, I'm sorry, to maintain a good seal of the tracheostomy tube in the airway so that the pressure that's going in goes straight into the lungs and doesn't leak out around the tracheostomy tube. Tracheostomy tubes can be flush with the neck as the ones on the right are. And then we also have some that have extensions, as is seen over on the left. That can be helpful if you have a smaller child that doesn't have a whole lot of much of a neck to be able to accommodate for having something between the chin and the chest. And then there are two different types of ventilation that I mentioned. One are what we call respiratory assist or bilevel positive airway pressure devices. And these devices are specifically made just for nighttime or intermittent use. They are not equipped for continuous use, nighttime and daytime. And when we've used them like that in the past, before we had good portable ventilators, what would happen is that they would burn out. And so we'd have to have two just alternate. We now have very good ventilators that can be used continuously, and both these devices are ones that we use routinely in patients who are on both non-invasive and then invasive ventilation. So then the question comes, how do we start non-invasive ventilation? And the traditional approach, tried and true, is to do that in the sleep lab. And the advantage of doing that is that we can monitor oxygen and carbon dioxide and make sure that the settings that we come up with are supporting the patient as fully as possible, as is possible. The alternate approach that we've also used is to do this in the inpatient setting, in the hospital on a pulmonary or a respiratory ward of some sort. The disadvantage of that is that it's very expensive, and at least in pediatrics, we're typically are limited in bed capacity. The new alternative that I'd mentioned earlier that some of our adult colleagues are using is actually initiating ventilation to as a level that we feel is appropriate in the office, and then confirming adequacy of ventilation by doing carbon dioxide monitoring at home. And this is the direction that we and many are going, because it allows the ultimate confirmation of support to be done in the patient's own home environment. So I want to move into talking about tracheostomy tubes. There are a number of benefits to having a tracheostomy tube. By far and away, to me, the biggest benefit is that it's the most stable airway. For obvious reasons, it's attached with trach ties to the neck. So it's very difficult to move or displace. And the other advantage is that It allows full ventilation during all activities. And we often will move with our younger patients towards having a tracheostomy tube, even if it's temporary, so that they can do physical therapy and rehabilitation therapy. The other advantage that I recognized in part because a couple of families of my patients had mentioned is that they can actually see their child's face and their child can actually see without something on their face. So that has certain advantages that are certainly within the realm of quality of life. The number of challenges narrows the effective airway, going from something that might be the size of your finger to something that would be the size of a pen or a pencil. And that means that that smaller airway is more prone to getting blocked with mucus if there's increased mucus. And because of that, there's need for highly trained, skilled caregivers, both parents and then nurses. And a child with a tracheostomy tube effectively needs to be continuously monitored or continuously have somebody that could change the trach if needed. And without that, there's the potential if there's a need for an acute trach change that if it's not done timely, that the patient could suffer because of the low oxygen that would occur during a plugged tracheostomy tube. So in terms of the need, the only absolute needs, in my view, are having an unstable upper airway, meaning you can't breathe without a breathing tube, which is kind of obvious. The other is if you're unable to maintain a nasal or an oral interface to allow for ventilation, or if the pressures needed for ventilation are higher than what can be done comfortably with a non-invasive nasal or oral interface, then that would be a reason to have a tracheostomy tube. There's some relative indications that are by no means absolute, and that is duration of ventilation. Some people would say, well, if you need ventilation during the day or even continuously, you absolutely need to be on use a tracheostomy tube, and that is absolutely false. The trade-off is that you have to be comfortable using a combination of interfaces, a nasal interface during the night and an oral interface during the day, or have to be exceptionally good at maintaining skin integrity under the nasal interface. And I've had patients who, through their entire adult life, used nasal interfaces continuously, and their caregivers did an absolutely wonderful job of maintaining their skin under the interface so that they can continue to use the interface. The other challenge, of course, is if somebody has discomfort in using a nasal interface or switching between an oral and nasal interface, then a tracheostomy tube would be a reasonable alternative. The contraindications include access to the neck. Sometimes we have patients that have cervical kyphosis, which is where your chin is to the chest, and literally you cannot expose the neck to be able to insert a tracheostomy tube. And then, if we have a patient that's just not able to provide, I'm sorry, a family that's not able to provide the support that a patient needs, then we would discourage a family from pursuing a tracheostomy tube. Ultimately, this has to be a conversation and is not something that should be a one-way conversation with somebody imparting their biases and recommendations, as well-intentioned as they may be. It should be a back and forth. It's perfectly reasonable to say, in my opinion, a tracheostomy tube would be valuable, but that does not mean that a tracheostomy tube needs to be inserted. And then there should be a back and forth looking at the positives and negatives for a particular patient. And ultimately, it's a quality of life decision that the patient and their family support should be making. So I want to finish by talking about managing challenges in ventilation. To me, the biggest challenge is interface, and both finding a mask that fits and can be maintained suitably, but also one that allows a patient to see well. And if a patient's asleep at night, that becomes less of an issue. But if you're using a nasal mask during the day, that can become a big issue. And also figuring out a way to optimally tighten the straps to maintain both a good seal, but also try and minimize discomfort and minimize skin irritation. What we try very hard to do with our families is have them find just the perfect tension to have in the straps to keep the interface working, but not pressure the skin too much. Because if you put too much pressure on the skin, you can get both irritation and then skin breakdown. And then that means that you can't use that interface anymore. And then the other thing is that our pediatric patients grow. And any patient can have a change in their facial structure, with either increased weight, decreased weight, or being just generally bigger. And so it's important to regularly assess mask fit. And then look for signs, early signs of skin irritation, such as red spots underneath pressure points on the nasal interface. For the ventilator, what we need to do is make sure that the ventilator is what we call synchronized with the patient's breathing. And that includes both inspiration, having a patient get a breath when they want one. It's awful uncomfortable if you can't breathe, if you're not getting a breath when you're wanting one. And then also having the breath stop when you're done getting a breath. And it's not comfortable having air continuously blowing in after you've finished breathing in. And then the other thing that we have to do is we can customize the size of breaths, and that will need to go up as time goes on, as patients get bigger and their needs get bigger. And then also having the air go in at the right speed or flow. If the air is going in too slow, you'll get a sensation of not of what we call dyspnea or breathlessness, not getting the breath that you want. Even though that it'll eventually get in, it's not getting in a way that the patient is comfortable with. And then sometimes we need to have different types of settings for both awake versus sleep based on the patient's needs, and then certainly going up when a patient falls ill. One of the things we can do is we can actually remotely track how well a ventilator is working by downloading data that's collected and stored in the ventilator, and then actually doing capnography at home using a transcutaneous monitor. And so moving into maximizing success requires routinely following up with the prescribing pulmonologist or other respiratory support person. To make sure that the ventilator is working well for the patient, and make sure that the interface is both stable on the patient and that the patient's actually getting an improvement in energy. That's something that we typically see very significantly after initiating ventilation. We can query the data collected in the ventilator to look at whether the settings are being attained, the pressures, and whether there's a leak in the circuit. And we can also get a sense of how widely it's being used. If we see that a ventilator, which is supposed to be used at night for the entire sleep, is only being used for 90 minutes, then we can have a conversation remotely about what we can do better, why it's not being used as widely as it should be. And then we can correlate that with carbon dioxide. And then in terms of routine surveillance, we can do a serum bicarbonate level to look for compensation for high carbon dioxide. And then we can do end-tidal or transcutaneous CO2 and then oximetry while the patient's awake. We can do home capnography and then get a follow-up sleep study also to see how well ventilation is working. And this is just to finish, this is an article published by my colleague at Penn, Jason Akervo, looking at this type of information. So we as the clinician can ask the medical equipment company to query the ventilator in the patient's home, and then that data would come to us as the clinician, and we can see use, which is reflected here, seeing that the patient, with some brief pauses during the night, was on ventilation during a reasonable amount of time. And then we can look at the minute ventilation or the adequacy of ventilation through the week, looking at a combination of both the minute ventilation, the tidal volume, the size of the breath, and make sure that it's at a level that we want. And then look at the pressures attained on the ventilator. We often will, for non-invasive ventilation, use a high pressure and a low pressure. And we can see if the ventilator is generally reaching those pressures. If not, then that can go along with a leak. And that's what this is actually reflecting. Here we can see through the night, between 11, 2300 and midnight, that there is a decrease in the tidal volume that the ventilator was delivering. And also, the ventilator can recognize when there's a leak in the circuit. And you can see that both between 11 and midnight, and then just before 5 a.m., there was a leak in the patient that, I'm sorry, in the circuit. That could be because the patient may have rolled over and the mask may have gotten displaced from the face a little bit. But thankfully, that's correctable. And if the mask is on and the interface is working effectively, the patient should breathe just fine. And so, in conclusion, treating hypoventilation is critical in giving patients the chance to reach their full potential and optimize function during the day, and frankly, quality of life, in my view. There are many interfaces and types of ventilation that can be used, and there's no rules. There's nothing that says that everybody has to be on this, use this interface or this type of ventilation. It should be customized to the patient and what they feel is best for them. And then being flexible in implementing ventilatory support is critical in meeting the patient's needs and maximizing success and quality of life. And so, with that, I'll finish and be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you so much. There's so much there to unpack. And if you want to go ahead
Oh, I'm sure.
but we've had a lot of questions come through.
Great.
And I'm curious, I want to start because you were talking about and I probably will say this wrong, but I wrote it down, the capnography. How do
Yeah.
you say it?
Capnography. CO2.
Okay, so if your current pulmonologist does not use that at home to like evaluate how you're doing at home, how do you talk to your pulmonologist about
Well,
that?
let me just be fair and say that this is something that's still fairly new and is not widely done. But the bigger issue, if you're an adult, is if you're getting a sleep study. The typical adult sleep studies are done for patients that have obstructive sleep apnea, where oxygen is the primary thing that's tracked and not carbon dioxide for reasons that I cannot explain, but it's a reality. And so, if you are wanting to see whether your ventilation support is working well for you and you're able to get a sleep study, then it absolutely needs to be done in a sleep lab that tracks carbon dioxide. And being told otherwise is just not really appropriate.
That's super
In
helpful.
time, I'm hoping that it will be more accessible to be able to do a home capnography. But unfortunately, that's not, it's done at some centers, but it's not by any means the standard of care. It's sort of the next phase of standard of care, if you will.
So if you're a patient that has a lot of variability in your breathing, because you talked about like when you're sick versus when you're well, but right, for mito patients, it could be a good day versus a bad day versus a sick day. How, like, if you
No.
don't have access to the capnography system, like how do you track that? Because like when you go in to see your respiratory therapist, it could be a good day, it could be a middle day, or how do you approach that?
Well, so I think the first thing is most patients who are on, if you have an oxygen monitor, it's not useless. It can be useful. But if one of my mitochondrial patients or a patient with neuromuscular disease were to call it, and say, I'm not feeling well, feel like I'm getting sick, or my energy level is down. One of the first things that we would think about would be ventilation at night. And so, what we may do is say, well, all right, well, let's have you do more rest on on the ventilator. Take a break and go on BiPAP. And sometimes we'll say, well, let's just go up on the pressures on the ventilator so you can get a bigger breath. We do that routinely in patients who are ventilated by tracheostomy tube, patients with neuromuscular disease and patients without neuromuscular disease. But there's no reason why it can't be done for patients with that are on nasal ventilation or oral ventilation.
Okay, so I'm gonna try to tackle. There's a lot of questions here, so they might come at you at random instead of order. When you see your sleep doctor, should you inform them that you have a muscular disease if they're not aware?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And can you explain like how they would explain how their treatment might be different? I know you mentioned about the need for the carbon dioxide issue, but are there other things? And then the patient also asks, is there continuing education for them concerning this difference?
Well, I'll answer the questions in series. So,
Okay.
first, the other part of all of this is, of course, airway clearance. We need to make sure that a patient has an adequate airway clearance regimen. The cough assist is what we typically will use if a patient's not able to cough effectively. And so that's also a critical issue. If you find that at night you're having trouble sleeping well and you feel like you're having secretions in your central airway or in your lungs, addressing that is also very important. The other question was, I'm sorry, I forgot already.
And I hold on 1 second. Let me. Is the treatment different if you have a neuromuscular
Oh,
disease
yes.
versus if you don't?
Yes, in part because if you're seeing a pulmonologist trying to address why am I not sleeping well at night, the first focus needs to be on whether you're ventilating well. Ventilation meaning bringing in oxygen and removing carbon dioxide. And so if the focus is just on oxygen, then you can miss somebody who's having hypoventilation. And in the sleep study that I showed you, the example of, it's a perfect example where you have somebody that has high carbon dioxide but normal oxygen at night. And so the focus needs to be away from what is the oxygen level through the night to what is the carbon dioxide level. And that needs to be part, as simply put, that needs to be, well, maybe it shouldn't be assumed, but it needs to be made very clear that that needs to be part of whatever assessment is being done.
So from a patient standpoint, I mean, outside of they can mention to their pulmonologist, hey, there's this great expert series that I really want you to like watch, so just to make sure that you're aware of it, like could they bring, you mentioned that paper that you wrote. I'm curious if there's other educational things that patients can kind of bring to their pulmonologist if they're adults and they feel like it could be missed.
There are documents for care of patients with neuromuscular disease in general, not specific for mitochondrial disorders. There's certainly quite a bit in ALS and in muscular dystrophies and in SMA. And I think one of the challenges with mitochondrial disease is sort of understanding, well, where does that fit in? You all know it very well. You can be fine, and then the bottom falls out, and then all of a sudden you're having major, respiratory difficulties. And people like physicians like to function from a paradigm of sort of understanding where they should go when something happens. And, I wish there were a mitochondrial standard of care document that is in the literature that somebody could refer to. So it would be very easy. Without that, what we need to do is say, look, I have a neuromuscular condition where I'm prone to periods of very dramatic weakness, and I need to be treated as a neuromuscular patient, just like as if I had muscular dystrophy or spinal muscular atrophy. And if somebody says, oh, I know muscular dystrophy, or I know ALS, I know SMA, then it should be a natural extension to say, all right, I got it. We need to do measure the CO2, see if you need to be on ventilation. We need to do airway clearance.
Now, I like that it's helping to help them shift their paradigm a little bit and just kind of categorize you in a bit of a different way. So that makes a lot of sense. Another patient asked, they said, my doctor currently sets my ventilator to provide pressure support for a certain tidal volume. I often feel though that I need more support for my tired respiratory muscles. She is worried that increasing it would give me too high a tidal volume for my weight. But I find that tiring out quickly in conversations and even become sweaty if I've ha as if I've exercised just from talking. Do you have any suggestions on how to approach this and are there particular follow-up questions I could ask her?
So, one of the questions is, well, first of the question should be, what if you do go up on the tidal volume. One of the things that we don't want to do is make the carbon dioxide level too low. And so the response of, oh, well, it's more too much for your size. What we do is we calculate the tidal volume relative to your weight. And we want to have it between roughly 6 and 8 milliliters per kilogram. And so if going up by another 100 milliliters or something means that you're getting 12 milliliters per kilogram, you may wash what we call wash out your carbon dioxide and have it be too low. And that can also impact things negatively. Not quite as bad as having high carbon dioxide, but it's still not ideal. So that's the pushback that your physician is offering. There are a number of other things that can be done. One I had mentioned in sort of setting the ventilator. If you feel like I'm breathing, the ventilator's giving a breath, but I just don't feel like I'm getting air. One of the things that can happen is I'm sorry, one of the things that can be done is to make the breath go in faster. There's something called the rise time, which is how fast the breath goes in. If it's slow, you are sitting there wondering, when is my breath going to get in? Versus if it's fast and it shoots right in, that can give you a sense of I'm getting a very satisfying breath in very quickly, and I feel much better. It's not giving a bigger breath, it's just getting it in faster. And it relieves the sense of what we call dyspnea or breathlessness, which, when you describe feeling like I've exercised or been active, that's effectively what you're feeling.
That's really helpful. So this moves to us kind of a saliva question. Is there a best way to manage the excessive saliva flow from possible problems with swallowing?
Well, I'll answer it in two ways. Speech therapy, if it's not being done. I always feel that if you can maintain the dynamic functioning of the body in some manner, it makes things so much easier than having to use medicines. The biggest problem with medicines, whether it's an anticholinergic like glycopyrrolate or scopolamine, that's on or off. It's very hard to titrate and certainly impossible to make it dynamic, meaning that if I happen to be salivating more for some reason, that my body responds and can clear that better, which is what you would expect. Or, the glycopyrrolate's not going to change the dose. It's there, or it's not there. And then I, but beyond that, I really, really try hard not to do the next on or off thing, which is Botox injections into the salivary glands. But if you're not able to regain or improve swallowing function with speech therapy, then the best approach would be suctioning and then also, using something like glycopyrrolate, which you can pause if things are getting too thick.
What is the challenge with a feeding tube and having an IVAPS? Is it better to switch to an invasive ventilation in that case?
No, feeding tube just right into the stomach, there should be no issue. If it's a feeding tube through the nose, that you can still use a nasal mask with that. That to me would not be a reason to shift to, having a tracheostomy tube if that's what is being asked.
And maybe like if it is an NG tube, that it wouldn't be worth getting necessarily like a gastric tube, because you're saying it shouldn't affect the airflow that much if it is an NG tube.
No, but I would, the problem is that if you have an NG tube, that's going to be irritating and it will also produce secretions. So, my general feeling is that you can't do oral feedings, it's reasonable to use an NG tube for a period of time. But then if the need persists, then it's much better, in my view, to do transition to a gastric tube.
So you talked a little bit about the importance of not getting irritation with your skin and how that can affect your ability to use the masks. So this patient asked for practical suggestions. Do you have any more practical solutions when the area around the nose struggles with dermatitis or eczema? This patient notes that they get sweaty when they're using their ventilator, and they cover part of their cheek with a cloth, and that seems to help. But do you think small amounts of gauze, like closer to the nose, would help? Will that affect like the seal?
Yeah, I mean the there's something called Tegaderm, which is a gel. It sort of looks like a bandage. It's a gel that you can put on underneath pressure points on the mask, or if there's a little bit of a leak, and that can sort of fill the leak, if you will. I've had patients that mother. It's actually more with the spacer on top of the forehead, using cosmetic pads or something to provide some cushioning. But for the actual seal, putting something like Tegaderm on the face can, I think, do a lot to try and improve seal.
This is going to be a mouthful, and I know that you can't give direct medical advice, but I wanted to paint a picture, and then maybe you can say what you can say, and then maybe I can connect you with this patient's doctor afterwards if they have more questions. This patient said I had a sleep study, and they found that I have 67 apnea events per hour, both obstructive and central. They did a follow-up sleep study with a CPAP and a BiPAP, and they decided to use the CPAP because my asynchronous breathing was too random, and they found that the BiPAP made it worse. They found my O2 was below 90%, 14%, and under 80% for a 1% to 2%. It says NOCO2 test was done. I'm using a CPAP and my events are now down to about 16 events per hour. Breathing out is difficult. A breathing test found my MEP was 40% and my MIP was 16%. And I have episodes when I cannot breathe and are out for 2 to 40 seconds. My pulmonologist does not know what to do about it. Where do I go from here? Or maybe who should I go to from here?
Just in very general terms, with that level of muscle weakness, to me, the approach would be ventilation, and CPAP is not ventilation. CPAP is just helping to keep the upper airway open. I'd be a little curious as to what the challenge was with bilevel positive airway pressure. Admittedly, because it's biphasic, meaning applies a pressure when you're breathing in and then releases that pressure. It needs to be done synchronously with the patient, and it sounds like that might, and if it's not, frankly, it can make matters worse. So I wonder if that was some of the challenge, and if it's a true apnea where there's a pause in breathing and not a hypopnea, which is a decrease in breathing, then that can alter the approach. And I can understand if it was all apneas, meaning no air getting in, that the approach that you would want to take is by using, CPAP. But in my neuromuscular patients, I always do that very trans, you know, very not permanently, because there's a very likely it's very likely that the patient will transition over to needing full ventilatory support.
So if you're an adult and you're not in a neuromuscular clinic, how do you find or access a pulmonologist who's more familiar with neuromuscular conditions? Is there a better way to do that than others?
Well, I wish I could refer you to a document that has a list of everybody. I can't really do that. One of the possibilities would be to task the primary care provider with that, or simply Googling, or doing a literature search. And if you do that, you may, over time, and using different search strategies, see familiar names. The primary care provider might say, "Oh, well, I know there's this doctor in Des Moines, Iowa, who does really good work, and you don't want to go to Ames because there's nobody there." So I think one of the things that I th that community of pulmonologists that manage patients with neuromuscular disease is deficient in is having sort of a search yellow pages type thing, and we're actually have recognized that and are working on trying to impact. I'm sorry, change that. Like, I know adult pulmonologists, and if you say I'm going to Palo Alto, I could probably figure out who to recommend. I wish I could give you a better answer than that, but it's unfortunately a deficiency.
That's okay. I know where to find you. So I might be reaching out more to see if you know a clinician in certain locations.
And unfortunately, I need to sign off and get back to patient care. But I
Okay.
wanted to thank you for the opportunity. I'm happy if there are additional questions. If Stephanie emails them, I'd be happy to address them.
Absolutely, absolutely. We really, really appreciate your time today and everything that you give to our community. And know that if you have asked questions and I didn't get to them, I will jot them down and try to make sure that you get those answers. Just thank you
Yeah.
so much, Dr. Murray. We really, really appreciate you. And
You're welcome.
thanks for all the work that you're doing for this community.
It's my pleasure. You guys take care. Stay well.
Have a good day.